He said, "How do I build trust?" I said, "How have you done in the past?" He says, "Normally I go in and tell them this is how you build trust with me." And I said, "Don't do that. I want you to walk in that room and look at the people and tell them, say right out front, I trust you. Here's how you can lose my trust."
Hi, and welcome to Lead Well. Today I'm joined by Stephen Howard. Stephen, you are the creator of Humoni Leadership. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Very close. I call it Humoni, like human with a Y. I'll explain later why.
Okay, cool. And you are an author of more than 20 books on leadership and organizational culture, which is fantastic. So we can also look into that. And your work focuses on a simple but very demanding idea that leadership is not about managing tasks, but about leading human beings. And taking everything into account that is related to the human side of working with others. So you're drawing on the case of international experience. You've been traveling a lot, and you challenge leaders to build cultures grounded in humanity, harmony, and accountability. So let's talk about what people-centric leadership really means for you, where it gets difficult, and why it matters now more than ever. Hi again, Stephen.
Thank you, Christine. Yeah, and it is a straightforward philosophy. It's very simple. I tell people you manage tasks, you manage processes, procedures, you manage policies, but you lead people and you don't manage people. And on occasion, you have to manage people, there's no doubt. But if you're managing people 85% of the time and leading 15% of the time, you're doing it wrong. And so you need to do it the opposite and have that manager hat on as little as possible.
So where do you see people confusing the two most often?
The thing is, so many managers have this tendency to believe that they always have to be right. They always have to have all the answers and they know best. And in today's world, that used to be true maybe in the 60s and 70s. But in today's world, we're hiring people for the brain. So if you're going to hire somebody for the brains and then tell them how to use that brain, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And you hired people for their hands and then you told them how to do something, how to manufacture this, how to follow this process, how to follow this procedure. But today, for sustained success, and I say sustained and not sustainable, I'm not talking environmental here, but for sustained success, you need to repeat and replicate the things you're doing well, but you also need innovation. You need creativity. And that comes from letting people be involved in the process.
And I think it also requires people to be motivated on their own. So what can I do as a manager to make sure that my people are as motivated as I need them to be?
I love that question, Christine. And the number one thing is to give them what I call reinforcing feedback. So first of all, take the words negative and positive out of your vocabulary when it comes to feedback there. If your intention of feedback is to help someone improve, improve their attitude, improve their behavior, improve their results, there's nothing negative about that. So take that whole concept out first. Reinforcing feedback is so important because people need to know when they're doing things right and when they're doing things well. And so many managers that I talk to push back on that and say, "Hey, we pay these people good money. Why do I have to tell them they're doing a good job?" The answer is because that's what motivates them. And if you go through a year without your boss telling you specifically where you've done a good job, not just, "Hey, good job," or "Hey, thanks for that effort," but which it can't be repeated or replicated. But if I tell you specifically what you're doing well and the value that you're contributing, whether it's to this project, to this team, to an internal customer, to an external customer, people are motivated. And they will now perform better. And you don't have to worry about micromanage them so much. So positive reinforcing feedback is such a critical aspect of motivation that is lacking in today's world.
And I'm smiling a bit here because I also work with people and their animals. And it's exact same thing for animals because there are so many people who tell their dog, "No, don't do that and don't do this." And they're not reinforcing what they actually want to see. So it's very similar, really.
And I read some research that this organization researched over 200,000 people, and 67% of them who'd left their jobs stated that they had gotten no feedback in the previous 12 months, none whatsoever. And we're human beings, and that's where humanity comes in. We're leading human beings. We're not leading assets. We're not leading resources. We're not leading digits. We're not leading engineers. We're not leading clerical people. We're not leading scientists. We are leading human beings first. And therefore, we have to understand what motivates a human being.
Now I'm interested in one point because I'm working a lot with leaders as a coach, and quite a few of them, especially the younger ones, the younger generations, they are extremely afraid of micromanaging. And so they're not giving feedback, they're not catching up with their people because they're afraid that this could be seen as micromanaging. What do you respond to that?
Then they've gone too far the other way. So they've gone to abandonment. And we don't want to micromanage our people. We don't want to abandon them either. And if they're in that full, we need to pull them towards the middle. People do want to be led. They don't necessarily want to be managed, but want to be led. And but you lead people by teaching them, by mentoring. And a key aspect of being a leader, even if you're a young leader, is you need to mentor the people below you or even your colleagues. You mentor them. And so that's where they're doing it wrong. They've gone too far to the opposite side.
So, what is your definition or an understanding of mentoring? Because I've heard different people talk about that term differently.
Yeah, and in English language, we interchange the word coaching and mentoring too often, quite frankly. If you want to be form, we want to formalize this. Coaching to me is helping individuals improve their capability, their capacity, and most importantly, their confidence for their current work assignment and maybe a stretch assignment. Mentoring is more longer term. If it's more formal, talk more about their career path, maybe getting new skills, being able to move into different parts of the organization so they get cross-functional training. That to me is more mentoring on a formal basis. But in English, even I interchange the words when I'm talking, I'm coaching a person or I'm mentoring this person. It's more of a one-on-one situation.
And I think you also coined the term micro mentoring. Is that correct?
I did. And that's just the thing of not worrying about mentoring on a formal basis. And on a formal basis, sometimes in a big organization, you actually have a formal mentor, somebody you don't report to, maybe somebody in a different part of the organization, and they become your mentor. But again, more on career path. Micro mentoring is more about just the day-to-day type activity. So the coaching and micro mentoring go hand in hand. I think the micro mentoring I'm talking about sometimes is when the person comes to you for advice. And whereas coaching is you as a leader need to be proactive in your coaching. Don't wait for people to come to you. Mentoring, sometimes you wait for the person to come to you because they see an opportunity, for instance, and they're not sure if it's right for them, and they want that personal, confidential type help advice that they're seeking.
Wow. So this human leadership sounds really appealing and but to me still a bit vague. So what would someone need to do when they go back to the office tomorrow? Where would they need to focus? What would they need to probably validate of what they're doing currently?
Yeah, to become a people leader means you put your people first. It does it. This is not people instead of profits or people over profits. This is just putting your people first. So it's understanding, first of all, it's a mindset change. And so it's more of a mindset change than a skill change, quite frankly. So you have to start thinking, okay, I have people. Everyone on my team is different. I'm going to have to lead them differently, slightly. They each have some individual aspects I need to focus on. Adaptability is critical in today's workplace. I need to be more flexible. I remember when my first job, Christine, out of university was in Texas. Now, I grew up in Las Vegas, young guy in Las Vegas, a crazy town, and I had a crazy attitude. And I go to Texas, and my boss was what we call good old boy, big Texan, been in the company like 20 years. And I'd been there 3 months or so, and I went to him. I said, "Hey, boss, on Thursday I'm going to be out of the office from about 11 to 12:30. I've got a dental appointment, then I'll take my lunch on the way back." And my boss just stopped and stared at me and leaned over me, and he said, "What's wrong, Stephen? Your dentist doesn't work on Saturdays?" It was like you couldn't take time off to go see the dentist on company time. But today's world, everyone knows, no, we have to be flexible. If an employee needs to see the dentist, or hey, even if they need to go see their children's piano recital at school and happens at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, let them go. They'll get their work done. So trust plays a big part of this. Part of the mindset is you have to trust that people will get their work done, that don't have to do it in this place between these hours of the day on these days of the week. That's a mindset change.
I fully agree with you. So I couldn't agree more. On the other hand, what I'm seeing in today's business environments is that there are quite a few voices coming up again, I would say, that think that this people-centric leadership is too soft. And for example, when I had a conversation around this topic or a presentation around this topic to a room full of leaders, one of them came to me afterwards and said, "Christine, if they don't want to work with me, they just should leave." So, what's your view on that?
And he's right, they're going to leave. Not that they should leave, but they will leave. And then, so is that the kind of leader you want to be? Is that what you want on your legacy, that you turned over your staff? And then you think about that, maybe that leader gets results, but at what cost, and what cost to the company? So one of the problems in organizations is, let's just take that leader, for instance, doesn't matter what department he's in. His department probably doesn't get hit with the recruitment costs that the HR function probably absorbs. So when that person leaves, then all that recruitment costs, all that on-the-job training, onboarding, all that may not hit his budget. So he may not see the impact, but the company sees the impact because it's going to cost the company when an employee leaves. Plus, he will get impacted when the rest of the team has to pick up the slack from the person who left, or multiple people who leave, which is going to cause stress and emotional unwell-being in his team, and probably friction and more drama. So the cost is maybe not on the bottom line, but the cost is there, and it's going to impact his team and perhaps impact his results down the road.
Yeah, and even when I was thinking about it, even when the person is still in the company, if they're not happy, they won't do the same quality of work and quantity of work they would do if they would be happy there, wouldn't they?
They'll do the bare minimum. They'll do exactly what they're told. And it goes back to my comment earlier. You've hired their brain, and now they're not bringing their brain to work. They're not bringing their passion to work. They're bringing their skill set. They'll accomplish their tasks, and that's it. And they won't evangelize anything. They won't be happy. It won't necessarily be a distraction. They're not going to be always a negative aspect to them, not like a bad apple, but they're going to get the bare minimum. And so that's a wasted asset, because that person has so many more capabilities that could be leveraged. And often, when a different boss comes into that department, suddenly those people who are only giving it just the minimum suddenly become stars, because they're allowed to bloom, they're allowed to flower, they're allowed to progress. So the person's only hurting himself and hurting his organization. And there's no negative if he changed. If he changed around to being a people-centric leader, I'm not saying you get this is instead of results. I'm not saying you have pizza parties every Friday, that you're not saying to people, come to work when you want to. No, there's still structure, there's still organization, but it's a better environment of for the team, and therefore the team produces better results.
Wow. And so you say positive feedback and feedback overall, or not positive feedback, but feedback when someone has done something good, and also, providing feedback overall is a great step. Micro-mentoring or mentoring overall is a great step. So what else can I do as a leader if I want to really be human-centric?
Remember that God gave you two ears and one mouth. Listen twice as much as you speak. As a leader, you'll learn a lot more. And I've got a couple of leaders I coach, and one of them I said recently, you know what, one of your problems is you're always the smartest person in the room. And so you're in the wrong room, because you're not learning. You're not leading. And so you don't bring in people who have different skill sets than you, different capabilities, are going to stretch you, that you're going to learn. But listen to the ideas, listen to the concerns, listen to what's not being said in the room. And then you're going to get greater involvement from your people, because success comes through people involvement, not people executing. It comes from their involvement.
Now, you have traveled the world and not only traveled, but also lived in different places. What kind of differences have you seen there in the different cultures?
There are many differences, particularly organizational. I lived in Asia for 21 years. And Asia, you can't think of like Europe. You can't think of Asia as just one melting pot. Japanese culture is very different from the culture in Thailand, than from Malaysia, than from India, Indonesia, any place else. So part of this is also you have to understand the country culture, of the people culture, and then the corporate culture. And sometimes the corporate culture will overrule the local culture. And that can be good. When I was a vice president of marketing in a US bank in Singapore, and we had a very different corporate culture. We had a very Citibank type culture with Citibank's the bank I worked for, compared to the local banks. In the local banks, it was very Asian, very hierarchical. Decision making was centered upwards, and people wouldn't make decisions. They were always waiting to be told. And that at that time was very Asian. It's changing a little bit now. But at Citibank, hell, I had people, assistant vice presidents making decisions. I had people managing level making decisions, and that was good. We forced decision making down as low as we could do it. And yeah, sometimes we made mistakes, but we recover from those mistakes and people learn. So the corporate culture is very important to what we're talking about, but also the culture of the organization, or sorry, the culture of the country. So for instance, in Thailand, I would never praise somebody in public, because they would back off. They don't want to be praised, and pull them aside and say, "Hey, you did a great job. Here's what you did well. Here's blah, blah, blah." They're very specific about it. But if you praise somebody in Thailand, they go, "Oh, like this." No, it was a team effort. It was a team effort, because they get embarrassed, because it is such a collectivist society in Thailand. So you also have to understand that as well when you're leading people internationally, to understand these little nuances between the cultures.
And where would you see, because I'm a European, I'm German, so where would you see the American culture at this point?
Unfortunately, I think the American culture is also moving a little bit in the wrong direction. It's moving a little bit towards the authoritarian side, and that's starting at the very top of the country. And I think that's where we're seeing some of these leaders who are saying, return to the office or else. And they're also going to find the or else is going to take place. I think we're going to see the Great Resignation 2.0 happening in parts of 2026 if this continues, because that lack of flexibility that people want, people need to be effective. But the American business culture always still remains time is money is the underlining aspect. So often I get involved in trying to help people work multiculturally. I actually wrote a book called Partnering Successfully with American Business Firms. And it talked about, like in India, they want to spend the first 10 or 15 minutes talking just socially about themselves, sports, family. And American goes in the meeting and they go, "Okay, we got 20 minutes. What's the first point on the agenda?" And Germans are a little like that, not necessarily, but whereas the Spanish and Italians are going to be more like people in India. They want to socialize a little bit more. They want to have a little bit of friendliness to it. So people have to adapt to each other's cultures. I'm not saying one has to totally turn, but you have to go back and forth, but most importantly, understand each other. When I go to Japan, I have a suit and tie on. My voice lowers. I'm very respectful. I'm more quieter in my meetings. I don't talk first. I'll let other people talk first. That's the Japanese culture. I understand that. Like I said, I lived in Asia for 21 years. I flex my style when, particularly, I'm in their country. If a Japanese person comes to America and I have a business meeting with them, not flexing as much. I still have probably more of my American characteristics in play, so to speak, like that little more hand gestures I would have if I had the meeting in San Francisco rather than in Tokyo. My hands are in my lap or on the desk and just nodding my head. So that makes sense. So understanding that these nuances again are very important, because we're dealing with people.
Yeah, and as you said at the beginning, there is the differences within the cultures, but also then the difference between people, because we're not all the same. And to me, it's always surprising, really, when I work with leaders that they're, wow, I haven't thought about that, that other people make decisions in a different way and have different kind of motivations than me. So it's a very important point. Now, you talked about being flexible, adjusting to different types of personalities and also different cultures. What is the part that you would not flex? What is it that is the kind of core of human-centric leadership?
The things you don't flex are things that involve legal, ethical, for policies that are not flexible. For what, for instance, of a policy like no weapons on site, or many of the oil companies have no alcohol, including in their car. You cannot have alcohol in the trunk or boot of your car and drive onto the parking lot of their facilities. That's a firing offense. So those are non-negotiables. Something that's socially inappropriate, foul language, sexual innuendos, bullying. Unfortunately, there's a fine line there. Bullying still happens in some organizations, but anything along those lines, there's no room for flexibility. There's flexibility to the point of maybe a one-time warning on certain things, but that's it. One time, two strikes, and you're out, so to speak. So there are some core things that, particularly when it comes to ethics and legal and anything that has huge financial ramifications, you can't commit the company to expenditures
Sure.
that it can't afford.
Now let me come back to an individual leader. So let's say that I'm a new leader and maybe I just take on a role or a new team or whatever. So what are my first indicators so that others can clearly see that I am a human-centric, humanic, harmony-related leader?
Great, great. And this happened recently, and I was coaching somebody on this, and they asked something similar. And I said, when you go in that first meeting, and this person was coming from outside the organization as well, I said, and he said, how do I build trust? With them? And I said, how have you done in the past? He says, normally I go in and tell them this is how you build trust with me. And I said, don't do that. I want you to walk in that room and look at the people and tell them, say right out front, I trust you. Here's how you can lose my trust. You can lie. You can sweep a problem under the, you can blame somebody else. You can not come to me when it's obvious this is beyond your capability. And that's why I'm here. I'm here to help you. If you spread innuendos about this is how you will lose my trust. But we're starting off on the basis of trust. And I hope you trust me. And here's how I'm going to show you. I'm going to walk my talk. I'm going to be transparent. I'm going to tell you when I don't have the answers, because I will admit right now, I don't have all the answers. But I do believe that together, this team and I, we can come up with good ideas, good solutions. So let's work together and start from there.
So you say trust is should already be in the room, not the one thing that I'm working towards.
Yeah, why should you have to earn my trust if I work for you? Wait a second, I've been hired here. The people who hired you trust me because they hired me before you. So all these things that go through people's heads, I think that's the first thing. The second thing I advise leaders to do, when you want to make a change, and you're going to think about it for days, weeks, hours, whatever, and not constantly, but it's going to be on your mind. And then when you get ready to present it, typically a leader will call a meeting for an hour, introduce the change in the first 15 minutes, and then spend the next 45 minutes saying, okay, let's talk about how we're going to implement this. When you introduce change, the first thing on everyone's mind is, what's in it for me? How is this going to impact me? And then how's this going to impact my work? And how's this going to impact my project? And all these things are in their head. But you're asking right away to talk about how to execute. So I suggest now hold two meetings. Have the first meeting, call a 20-minute meeting or 30-minute meeting if you want. Introduce the change, explain why the change is going to happen and when and the permutations of it and everything. And then ask people to think about it for 2 days and come back with their ideas of how to implement it. But more importantly, come back with what do they see as the hurdles that we might face that I haven't thought of as a leader? And what other opportunities have I not seen? You're on the front lines. You're out there talking with the customers. I'm not. What are the opportunities I don't see? And now let's talk about that 2 days or 3 days from now. So let them have time to digest it. They're going to talk about it amongst themselves. That's fine. Let them talk about it. Let them get it out of their system. Oh, this is a crazy idea. Oh, boss is stupid. Oh, here we go again. Let it get it out of the system. Now you can have a productive 30 or 45-minute meeting on how to execute it. And you're going to get greater buy-in from the team because now they're participating in the discussion on execution. They don't need to participate in the discussion of what. They need to participate in the discussion of how to do it. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I think the one change that is has already started and that will probably change the business environment quite a bit more is AI. So how do you see this human leadership capabilities and how they will become, what of the leadership capabilities will become non-negotiable in an AI-driven workplace?
I'm not sure yet, Christine. It's still early days, other than the ones we talked about earlier. I think what leaders will need to do is set the standards for how they want AI used in their organization. Now, I'm a writer. I will use AI for research purposes only. I will not have AI write a chapter of my book. I take pride in my writing, so that's my standard as an author. My graphic artist will use AI to create my covers. That's fine. That's his skill using AI. But I'm not going to use AI to write a book or write an article based on my book or anything else. So those are my standards. So in an organization, the leader has to say, how are we going to use AI? And how are we going to double check the accuracy? Because one of the issues still, AI can give us a lot of false information. And so how are we going to double check whatever we're using AI for in that regard? So now, using AI for efficiency to your spreadsheets, your calendar, use it. I've worked with a leader recently. We used AI to create a draft strategy, which is really good because it got some ideas on paper and a couple ideas that he had not thought of. But then he and I worked together on building, flushing that out so that it fit the organization. So it's a tool to be used without a doubt, but it's not the only tool, and it doesn't replace creativity and cognitive inputs and decision making.
And I guess the human aspect of leadership doesn't change with it either.
I don't think so. Here's what worries me is if it does, it's going to make it inauthentic. I was talking with a gentleman the other day about feedback. And he said, oh, I'll just get AI to write me some sentences. I'll put in this, the feedback form, the annual performance review. That's what it is. So he's going to submit the annual performance review to AI and have AI give him some sentences to use. And I said, if you use them verbatim, they're going to come across inauthentic. So if you want to use that as a draft to get your ideas to now be more specific when you talk with that employee, great. But if you just read a bunch of AI generated statements in a performance review, that person's going to see you so inauthentic, and your trust is going to go out the window.
So use it more as a, as you would have used an assistant probably in earlier times, not so
That's
much
what
as.
AI is. I mean, actually, you should talk to AI as if it's your assistant. You talk to that, it's your intern, is the best example I'm given. Go find me this. Go look at this. Go modify this. Let's see what it comes back with. Now, let's sit down, and that's some basic research. Let's figure out what we're going to do going forward.
And as a last question, what is your vision overall? Where does leadership go to move to over the next few years?
And honestly, I hope it moves more towards a human-y leadership style, whether people want to call it human-y or not, or just call it people-centric leadership. I think the organizations that inculcate, now, here's the other thing, Christine, an entire organization doesn't have to inculcate people-centric leadership. Just a department does. A manager, a team manager can do. So this doesn't have to start at the top. Anybody who leads a team of people, whether it's two people, 20 people, 200 or 200,000, if you're the CEO, can become a people-centric leader. So this is not something for people to sit around and wait for the CEO to read the book and say, okay, we're going to change our style here. No, you change. You read it, you change, and implement it within the part of the organization that you can influence. And then you're going to get results, and then you're going to get promoted, and now you can put it into a larger part of the organization. So this is a good career path for people because people who use these concepts are going to achieve results. Again, it's not people instead of results. You're going to have lower employee turnover, you're going to have higher innovation, higher creativity, sustained results. Who do you think is going to get promoted when it comes around for the next opportunity? You are. So it's
And you then have the capabilities of becoming a leader, because I have seen so many individual contributors being promoted, and they
Yeah.
failed as leaders because they did not have that.
Or any other thing, or anything else. They're told on Thursday they're going to take over the team on Monday, and they have no help in doing so. And so they lead the way they've been led. Actually, in truth, they manage the way they've been managed, and they don't become leaders. So very few people have had good leaders to mimic. So we're hopefully changing that.
That's that, I'm sure. So, where can people find more about your work?
I'm on LinkedIn at Stephen Howard. There's a few Stephen Howards, I'm in Phoenix, Arizona, so you can find that. I'm on Amazon. Name of the book is Humany Leadership. I've written a more recent book you see there by my name, Humany Mindset, which takes this concept out of the workplace into the public world. Or just write me, Stephen, Stevenn. So is it V and an N, Stephen at Humany, Humony, leadership.com. And I'll reply within 48 hours. I do travel a bit, so I may not reply the same day, but give me 48 hours and I'll respond to any emails.
Wow, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for all your wonderful wisdom and insights. And yeah, I'm looking forward to staying connected.
Thank you, Christine. Great conversation. I loved it. It was a very nice, open conversation, very enjoyable.
Thank you.
This was Lead Well. Now, what is the one thing that you're taking away from this episode? Please share in the comments below and do share the podcast with your friends and family, but only if you like it.